Good afternoon, and welcome to a special call focused on the election results and market impact. Hancock Horizon Investments provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during this call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Strategist John Portwood and Chief Investment Officer David Lundgren. And with that, David Lundgren will take over as the moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this afternoon. Obviously, it's been a very interesting 24 hours and wanted to have the opportunity to talk to everyone a little bit about the potential market and economic impact as a result of the election results last night. And by this point, I'm sure everyone is very well aware that Donald Trump it will be the next president of the United States of America. He, at last count, at least from confirmed electoral votes, and it really depends on which news source you go to, was at 279 electoral votes. It looks apparent that he will win Michigan and Arizona, which will put him at 306 electoral votes, and more than likely Hillary Clinton will win Minnesota and New Hampshire. Obviously, the presidential race has consumed the headlines not only today and yesterday, but really for most of the last 6 months. There were many other important races on who controlled Congress. And in the Senate, the Republicans have control. Last count, they were at 51. Still outstanding, there's a runoff in Louisiana. I believe that's on December 10th. And then New Hampshire, at the last time I looked, had not been decided. So somewhere between 51 and 53 seats for the Republicans. They entered the race having 54, so they lost somewhere between 1 and 3 states. I think the real important note here, much like the presidential race, I think a lot of the pundits and experts and even strategists that we cover felt like there was a good chance that the Democrats would control the Senate, or sort of a extreme case, it might be 50-50. So this was an unexpected outcome from that perspective. And then in the House, the Republicans remain in control. They did lose some seats. They lost somewhere between 5 and 7 seats. There's still 4 races undecided. And again, much like the presidential race and the Senate race, much better. The Republicans fared much better than expected. Heard numbers anywhere from them losing 10 to 20 seats in the election. Losing 5 to 7 is a much better outcome than many expected. So, John, you know, hearing those results, just wanted to get some general comments regarding what a surprise it was. And, you know, I've heard some people say, you know, we witnessed a fundamental change in the electorate. Heard others talk about, you know, potentially the biggest upset in presidential election history. Just give us a little color, if you could, regarding the outcome and maybe some of the reasons why.
Yeah, Dave, well, surprise probably is an understatement about what happened. It even turned out a little bit opposite to what some people thought in terms of the popular vote. There were stories going around that the popular vote would go to Trump, but that Clinton would win the Electoral College. And, of course, it turned out exactly opposite that. But looking at this I, from a big-picture standpoint and going back a number of years, one of our sources described the divisiveness, I guess, that if you call it, that has developed in the country as the city class versus the country class, people voting against the status quo, against the elites. I hate to use this term, but the 1%, you know, versus the 99%. whatever you want to call it, the academic term for it, I guess, is a rise of populism. I'm not sure even that is maybe the best way to describe this. It's cultural, it's economic, it's political. You not only see it here, but since the crash of 2008 and the credit bust, you've seen it manifest itself in the Eurozone with the crisis beginning in Greece and the rise of various left-wing and right-wing, according to their definition, parties that have challenged the status quo. So it's happened here. It's happening there. It's something of a revolution, I guess you would say. And my guess is that Trump's victory here will add impetus to what's happening in Europe, and we'll probably see more of an increase, I guess, in the anti-establishment parties and in the elections that are coming up. There's a fairly significant election coming up in Italy. It's a concern that the opposition party, and I've forgotten the name of it, Dave, if you can think of it, it's the Five Star Party, I think, in Italy, might come to power, which would create quite a bit of disturbance in Italy and perhaps even lead to a vote on whether or not Italy should remain in the Eurozone. So, you know, we've got probably a lot to look out for, I suppose, as this progresses. But this has been building for a while, and, you know, here we are, and it's probably not over yet.
John, I think, you know, one thing that's pretty interesting is that, you know, the reason that it's viewed as such an upset is because polling data, which a lot of pundits and strategists that we follow that I truly believe are unbiased and want to get good numbers, the polls have just been horrible. And you know, I read an interesting article this morning. You know, if you look at Brexit, there was an election in Colombia, the primaries, and then here, you know, in the election, polls have missed horribly. And the article that I read on Bloomberg talked about how, you know, the science of polling, instead of getting better, as you would think, as, you know, we had more technology and it would become more efficient, is getting worse. And they talked a little bit about part of the reason is fewer and fewer people having landlines. When you had a landline, you know, it was likely that you knew exactly where that person was located, and you had a pretty good demographic profile of that individual without having to ask them a lot of questions. Now, with people, you know, fewer and fewer landlines, people becoming more dependent on cell phones, it's harder and harder to really identify those characteristics. Additionally, another stat that I thought was really interesting is that, you know, back in the late 1990s, they did a survey. And, you know, roughly, I think the number was somewhere around 45%, it was mid-40s, of people were willing to participate. If they got a call from somebody doing a survey, almost a 50-50 chance that that person was going to participate. Those numbers have dropped tremendously to where now they're in the low teens. And I think this is just sort of an interesting aside, and it's important because, you know, a lot of decisions are based on, you know, a lot of these indications on where things are going. What are your general thoughts on polling data? Is it you know, going to reach a point where we don't even use or look at polling data in the future?
Well, it looks like they're certainly going to have to revise the system. Not only was there a polling issue here, but you mentioned Brexit, and there was an interesting situation in Britain surrounding Brexit, where personal calls were being answered in the affirmative in terms of remaining in the Eurozone with that special relationship that Britain has to the Eurozone, whereas the online emailed in numbers suggested something entirely different. The online voting, which was anonymous, said Leave was going to win. and the personal calls indicated that Romaine was going to win. That could be who they called. You know, that goes back again to, you know, your comments about calling people. Who answers the phone? And, you know, who did they call in Britain to get the initial results? And again, in Britain, it has a lot to do with you know, who lived in the cities and who lived in the countryside, you know, along with you know, where the vote went. And in Britain, they called it the shy vote. That's S-H-Y vote, that people did not respond properly to personal calls. They didn't want to appear to be out of the mainstream, I suppose, as it was perceived at the time. And they voted for leave anyway. So it looks like the polling data needs to be revised, or polling process needs to be revised considerably. But even the betting markets were horribly wrong. They were horribly wrong with the Brexit vote, and they were, you know, quite, you know, off base with ours. By the way, we don't allow online betting on elections and other things in the U.S. anymore. We used to a few years back, but that doesn't exist anymore. And I think this, if you want to participate in it, I think it's called Predict It. It may be coming from, it's coming from offshore, perhaps Australia or New Zealand, somewhere interesting. But in any case, yeah, something different is going to have to be done, I suppose, to get some, you know, better feel for actually what's happening on the ground.
Okay, thanks. Let's go ahead and shift and talk a little bit about the market and not only potential impact, but impact that we've seen just within the last 12 hours, 15 hours. When it became apparent that Trump was going to win, the futures sold off in a huge way. In global markets, really, you know, there was a fair amount of panic. You saw a large sell-off in Asian markets. But the Dow at one point was down more than 800 points. And then, and I've gotten this question several times from clients and coworkers, and we ended the day up 256. That is a massive move. You know, over 1,000 points shift in the Dow in that short period of time. What do you think the reason or the cause of that was?
Well, one reason for the volatility, of course, is that markets are infected, if you want to use the word, with all sorts of algorithms and high-frequency trading formulas that can react in a nanosecond to perceptions driven by whoever's on the other end of the trading process. And I guess you could say that initially, with no knowledge of whether or not the election would be contested and how close it might be and how long the uncertainty might last, the down 800 probably made sense. Once it became obvious that Trump was going to win by enough electoral votes to remove that thought that the election might be contested, then you're back up 200. And then you go into the comments by the contestants, and Trump made a very presidential acceptance speech, and Hillary Clinton made a very nice speech late this morning, and that probably gave the market some comfort that, you know, it was business as usual, at least for a short period of time, and I'm sure everybody was glad the election was over.
And let's kind of talk about going forward and, you know, a lot of the, I guess, the research that we've read, there's a fair amount of angst amongst market participants and investment professionals with Donald Trump as president. Why do you think there's that concern about him in that role?
Several major reasons. I guess we ought to start with trade. That's probably one of the biggest reasons, if not the biggest reason. Obviously, globalization, the widespread, you know, widening spread of trade around the world in the last several decades has added a lot to GDP growth. The idea that Trump might generate some sort of trade war with our trading partners certainly creates some some anxiety. I think that's probably a slim chance that that would happen, but nonetheless, you know, a disruption in world trade would not be good. Certainly, there's some geopolitical risk. You know, what will China, Iran, Russia, you know, what will they do? What will they say? Will they, you know, try to do something that would test Trump early in his presidency? By the way, the geopolitical risk today, if you read some folks who think they have a handle on history, the total picture today is very similar to what it was prior to World War II. It doesn't mean that that's what we're going to have, but it just points to a fairly, you know, unstable situation geopolitically, and there's always the chance that somebody will do something from that standpoint. And then there are whatever distractions that might occur during the Trump presidency. He was something of a wild card during the debates and during the election contest, and there's some concern that you know, that might be a distraction going forward.
Okay, well, let's shift gears a little bit to the potential positives, especially, you know, it hasn't happened too often where the Republicans control the executive branch as well as Congress. And is there some opportunity for legislative change that could be positive for the market and or economy? I'm assuming they sort of work hand in hand.
I think we've all read about the possibility of tax cuts under Trump. He's talked about improving the corporate tax rate, doing some structural reform of personal taxes. That certainly could be a positive. Repeal of Obamacare. Obamacare was hastily conceived and poorly constructed, and certainly something needs to be done there. It's implosion might not be the right word to use for it, but it's in trouble. And you know, that needs to be taken care of, and that's probably, well, certainly it is a positive. Less regulation is also a potential positive. We don't know how fast that might occur. Some regulatory issues he might be able to put in place by presidential fiat. Others may require a lot more discussion with Congress and everyone else involved. And then finally, you've got your infrastructure spending, defense and infrastructure spending that has certainly been talked about and is certainly possible. And to the degree that the infrastructure spending can be directed towards something more positive that might actually produce more productivity over time, that would be a positive.
Okay. And, you know, I guess one thing, you know, a lot of these, especially if you're right-leaning, all of these sound like good ideas. But, you know, when you think about some of the agenda items, you know, there's a lot of spending, you know, defense and infrastructure spending, repeal of Obamacare, border security, more than likely, you know, those three things together are going to come with, you know, a considerable amount of cost. And then on the other side, you know, we're talking about tax cuts where we're reducing government revenue. And, you know, it's simple math, right? If you increase spending and you lower tax revenues, you're looking at an increased deficit more than likely and more debt. And, you know, given where we are in the House, a lot of congressmen have been elected with, you know, running on a platform that talks about decreasing the deficit and reducing the amount of debt. How does that get reconciled? Or is that just part of the legislative process that's going to take time and might get ugly, even though, you know, it's Republicans across the board?
Well, it's the Financial Times had an interesting headline early this morning that said, U.S. bids farewell to campaign full of conflict and discord. The only thing they didn't add was, you know, welcome to the next administration full of conflict and discord. And It may not be as bad as we think it might be, but certainly it's not going to be an easy experience for, I don't think, for anybody. The increased spending and potentially, you know, no increase in tax revenues is a real serious issue when you've got the deficit we have currently and when you've got the debt level that has risen consistently over the last 7 or 8 years. Medicaid spending is, maybe it's Medicare, is up something like 40%. It's really been a significant increase. Something like 60% of government spending goes to entitlement programs, and there really isn't a lot of room to increase infrastructure spending significantly and defense spending without impacting the deficit in the short term. So trying to figure out exactly how to do this is not going to be easy, and I imagine there'll be a considerable amount of discussion about it. Well, one thing, and of course we know Congress likes to spend money. They don't like to spend as much as they used to, or they recognize that we have a structural problem and that might prevent some of the spending. Recent research has called into question the idea that infrastructure spending is always positive. The question is, how much is the multiplier effect, or does it really exist? And some of the recent research suggests that a lot of this government spending really has no multiplier effect beyond the first year or two and does nothing more than add to the debt later and create more issues that we have to deal with. So, you know, to the extent they can do something smarter, I suppose, it might be better. But as you said, it's going to be a contentious process. It won't be easy to figure out exactly what's going to happen, and we probably wouldn't see anything happening on the spending side until, my guess is, somewhere around the middle of next year.
Okay. And let's stay on the stock market and maybe think a little bit longer term. And on our monthly market and economic update calls, as a group, we've spent a lot of time, talking about being, somewhat cautious just because of where we are from a valuation perspective. And this, continued lack of significant growth in earnings and top-line growth as a result, we feel that returns going forward might be somewhat muted. Does this change that outlook any, or is it kind of a wait and see?
I think it's more wait and see. It could change the outlook in the short run. You know, if the markets perceive that enough infrastructure spending will take place and enough tax incentives, will take place to add something of a positive nature, then, that would certainly, help things in the short run, particularly if you begin to see some increase in earnings at the same time. You know, we've had relatively flat earnings growth here for a while. It was negative for a few quarters. Looks like it might turn back to the plus side by the end of the year, but not significantly. If you can get a little infrastructure spending and you can get some increase in earnings at the same time, it's going to be more positive than not. However, with valuation being what it is, stocks have gone up quite a bit based on what the central banks, have done. In fact, central banks have been better, more successful at raising asset values than they have really in doing much for the economy globally. Unless earnings increase significantly, that's probably not going to change very much. So we've still got the valuation problem. On the fundamental side, longer term, you've got some structural headwinds that are still there. The demographics are not favorable. We've got lower labor participation rate. Fewer people are working. People are getting older. The dependency ratio is rising. And we've still got a pretty heavy debt load. So it's going to be tricky trying to figure out how to restructure regulation and restructure taxes and and perhaps target some infrastructure spending that makes sense, and not and yet you know, not increase the debt, you know, or the deficit. So it's going to be kind of a tricky process. The other thing you have to worry about with infrastructure spending is if it gets really out of control and the Federal Reserve keeps their foot on the pedal and keeps interest rates relatively low and keeps stimulating the economy. If that happens, then you run into an inflation problem, which of course would impact stock prices. So, you know, we may not go there, but we're sort of, I guess we're kind of in an in-between situation. You know, we could be in a low interest rate, low inflation world for a long time due to some of the structural headwinds and all of this restructuring that may take place in terms of taxes and the economy might allow us to muddle through without having anything significant occur. However, if inflation gets out of control and interest rates rise too much, you know, then, you know, we're going to have some problems, but we'll just have to see how that works out. It's too early to tell.
Yep. Let's go ahead and talk about interest rates. And let's talk about the short end of the curve, which leads us to the Fed. Any chance that any of this, and I got two questions for you. Any chance that this has the Fed maybe not move in December? I think, you know, more than likely people think we're going to see 25 basis points. And then my second question, if you think about some of the comments from Donald Trump on the campaign trail, not a big fan of Janet Yellen, not a big fan of the Federal Reserve in general. Is that all just campaign talk and you know, unlikely anything comes of that? Or do we see some, you know, it's not going to happen in January, but, you know, do we see some movement on the central bank, how it operates, or who's the Fed chair?
You know, messing with the Fed early on is probably not a good idea. The Fed has never been completely apolitical in the past, but, you know, let's hope that an attack on the Fed initially, you know, right out of the gate doesn't happen. That probably would create a great deal of turmoil. As far as what the Fed is going to do in December, according to the odds today, there's still a 75-80% chance, according to the market betting, that the Fed is going to raise interest rates. Well, we think that's probably going to happen. The Fed has been more serious, I guess you'd say. They've talked about it a lot in recent years, but they've been more serious about it lately than they ever have been. And they want to get out of the business of manipulating markets and manipulating interest rates and try to move back toward something that looks relatively normal. I think they understand that they're in kind of a box and it's best to get out of this thing as quickly and hopefully as easily as they can. So I think they're still on the road to raise interest rates gradually. It probably won't happen quickly. Interest rates probably are in a bottoming process in here. It may last for quite some time. Like we mentioned, the structural headwinds that exist under those circumstances, it's hard to see a significant increase in interest rates with you know, relatively low growth and the debt and the demographics that we've got. But, you know, again, you know, the situation could change in 2 or 3 years. But for a while, it looks like interest rates will remain relatively stable, and any increase in short-term rates is going to be somewhat muted. But obviously, at the long end of the curve, long rates like the 30-year Treasury today had a very big move up in yield. The low,
yeah,
not long.
At the 10-year, you know, after Brexit, the 10-year was all the way down to 135. As of the close yesterday, we're at 185 and then closed at 205 today. So really significant jump in yields or decline in bond prices, however you want to look at it.
Yeah, it's a pretty big move. And we have to keep in mind that rates can't move up sharply without impacting the economy at this stage. The economy certainly is not strong enough, you know, to withstand considerably higher interest rates. So, you know, my guess is that, you know, interest rates are going to remain relatively stable toward the short end of the curve, and we'll probably see a lot of volatility at you know, looking at the 10-year treasury or the 30-year treasury as we try to work through, you know, this transition to a new administration. And finally, I think, Dave, both of us would agree that our opinion and our view of the future is probably subject to change as the situation changes. Nobody's ever seen anything quite like this. And if you listen to the news, you can probably find 40 or 50 different opinions just about every hour. So
well, everybody changed their opinions in one day, right? From
yeah. So we're taking it a day at a time. We think our views are reasonable and reasonably accurate, but obviously we reserve the right to change our mind if things develop differently.
Thank you, John. And thank you, everyone, for joining today. We'll conclude the call there.